The deed in question talked of the pharaoh during Ka-Ra's reign of power, Akhenaten. Like Ka-Ra, this pharaoh was not a popular leader among the Amun-Ra sect. Akhenaten was a sun worshiper. Although there were as many gods in Egypt as there were priests, Akhenaten's theology maintained the belief that there was only one significant force guiding the earth along her path. This was a huge threat to the other priests, who managed a terrific network of beliefs based on the various deity principles. Ka-Ra decided that the empire was too corrupted in its religious ranks, so she obtained a commission from the pharaoh to build a city-paradise far from the clutches of her other enemies so that Aten could be worshipped in peace. The tiny statue told the story of this great exodus and how she managed to create a perfect utopia. In the telling of this historical epic, the author made the fatal mistake of mentioning Ka-Ra's burial site, praising it in Aten's name. Proof of its authenticity. Parker dodged Sahisha's men, discovering the ancient doors cleverly hidden under an ancient trash mound. Ironic.
The ancient priests were perfectionists when it came to the powers of deceit. To think that I had always been so close.
Amin, always careful, realized that his friend was close to unleashing an evil long forgotten. Ka-Ra had once been a remarkable leader, but her power and isolation from the pharaoh polluted her mind with ambition. Amin pleaded for the digging to stop.
I should have listened to him. Damn my need for attention. When he was bitten by a poisonous scorpion and lost his leg, he pleaded. When tribesmen decided that they would hang him, I didn't listen. I was too caught up in the thrill of the moment.
So much work. So much sacrifice. All of it in vain. All of it shattered by a simple theft. Parker moaned with torment, sinking deeper into an exhausted sleep. April 12, 1912. Suite B-53, 12 o'clock a.m. Parker opened his eyes. The suite was engulfed in darkness, a darkness of many hours.
What time is it?
Parker asked, fighting the throbbing in his head. The drugs given to him for his fever had helped, but left a headache. He rubbed his eyes with his thumbs. A movement from the corner of the room caught Parker's attention. He was not alone. The shadow appeared to be feminine.
Who's there?
The shadow didn't move. It blended so well with the huge bedroom's background that it was nearly impossible to tell shadow from furniture. The red glow of a nearby electrical heater caught his eye. A flickering gas lamp had been placed on his nightstand, with a tray of hot tea kept warm in a silver serving pot. A grandfather clock began to ring out its Westminster chimes. Patiently he waited. In the darkness, he counted the chimes.
9, 10, 11. 12.
Parker couldn't believe how late it was. He was never a heavy sleeper and generally only required 5 to 6 hours to recharge his energies. Never had he slept so long. Again, the shadow moved. Parker stopped his breathing, his eyes focused on the unknown black form hiding behind an armchair.
Who is that?
He demanded, frightened. The shadow shifted from one foot to the other. Parker thought he heard the sounds of fingernails being bitten.
Please, sir, the shadow said. I meant no harm.
Step out where I can see you.
Slowly stepping forward, Catherine Lee, the chambermaid, gave Parker a nervous smile.
You were just so weak, and Mr. Andrews was busy with the captain and all.
Catherine fidgeted with her apron strings.
I volunteered to see to your comforts.
Parker lifted his bed covers to discover that he was naked. He pulled the covers over his chest tightly, glaring at the advancing female.
Where are my clothes?
In the smoking room,
Catherine instructed. She started taking off her white apron.
You really don't need them, do you?
Parker stared on, speechless. Catherine responded to Parker's uneasiness. She noted his emotions, his fears, and his excitement.
Would you like some tea?
She asked.
Huh?
Parker was lost in thought. Catherine silently asked him if he would like a cup of tea. Innocently, Parker nodded. Catherine smiled with anticipation. She knew that more lovemaking has been had from a cup of tea than any aphrodisiac known to man.
I'll have to treat him with kindness, Catherine surmised, pouring the tea. God knows men can be jumpy creatures.
For only a moment, Parker had managed to forget his troubles. Catherine poured him a tiny cup of tea. Parker was able to sneak a peek into the chambermaid's loose uniform. Pink breasts bobbed from side to side, showing a strange and inviting world to him.
How many lumps?
Catherine asked, suppressing a laugh, noticing Parker's stare. Parker broke his concentration.
What?
Catherine smiled. She knew what he was looking at.
Sugar? How much sugar would you like?
Embarrassed, Parker turned his eyes away. He had been caught.
No sugar.
Oh, a man who drinks his tea straight?
Catherine smiled.
I like that.
Parker continued to stare at the wonderful woman in front of him. He couldn't help it. It was a magical force he could not control. Catherine was about 5 foot in height, brunette, blue-eyed, and of distinguishable Irish descent. Her body was tiny and fragile, reminding Parker of a China doll. Her regal bearing only surpassed her sexuality. One would never take her for a servant. Parker's hand began to shake. He noticed the woman's wanting stare. Her dress hit the floor. Her body ventured next to his. Dennis Parker's universe shrunk to the little four-poster bed he occupied. Waves and waves of emotion started to completely extinguish his brain fever. Catherine softly moaned in Parker's ear. The years of loneliness were at an end. Orlop Deck, Boiler Room Number 6, 1:35 a.m. Andrews took a small work cloth lying on a stoker's work table and wiped off the sweat accumulating on his collar. It was too damn hot and something was wrong.
Are the fans working, Chief?
Chief Engineer Bell gave the shipbuilder a confirming grunt. Bell hated officials, but he considered Andrews to be his equal. Similar, in fact, that no one else knew the Titanic as he and Andrews did.
Aye, they're on.
Bell grabbed the towel from Andrews, wiping his own forehead.
Damned if I know what's wrong. It shouldn't be this hot. The boilers haven't even reached peak performance yet. Captain Smith wants a test run, but that's days away. Something's wrong, Chief.
Andrews walked closer to the bulkhead of Boiler Room 6.
Most of the heat's coming from this wall.
Andrews turned to Bell.
Got anything brewing in there?
Bell placed his hand in the air next to the iron wall. Inches away, he was tempted to feel the bulkhead, but caution had managed to drown his curiosity.
This is strange, he exclaimed. This wall's red hot. There's nothing on the other side, but...
He stopped, giving Andrews a horrified look.
Sir, it's coming from the coal bunkers.
It took a few seconds for the situation to sink in. Andrews had heard stories of coal fires on ships, and he was also aware of the deaths they caused. The Titanic would arrive in New York as a burnt-out hulk. Andrews turned, looking for the first officer.
Mr. Murdoch, Andrews yelled. We have a serious problem.
Will Murdoch, who had been searching the entire ship hoping to find Parker's missing mummy, ran into the boiler room, ripping his coat sleeve on a steam pipe near the door.
What's the problem here?
Murdoch wiped coal dust from his jacket while trying to hold up his sleeve.
Fire,
Andrews said. Murdoch let his sleeve fall. His eyes became as big as saucers.
A what?
Andrews turned from the wall.
We think that a fire has started in the next coal bunker.
He instructed Murdoch to place his hands near the wall.
Here, see for yourself.
Instead of touching the wall, which was never the first officer's intention, Murdoch studied the faces of the men around him. Murdoch didn't question. He didn't debate.
How bad?
Like a doctor checking his patient, Andrews studied the surface of the bulkhead. Everyone noticed his hands. They were shaking violently.
Most of the coal is still cold. However, if we don't get someone in there to stop it, it could get serious. Understood.
The first officer walked to a nearby communicator and lowered it down to where he could talk into it. The ship's communications on the Titanic were of a kind which would have made Marconi swell with envy. Before these marvels were installed, sailors spoke through tubes.
Bridge, we got a problem down here.
Murdoch placed his ear next to the communicator's receiver and heard a crackle of static. He repeated his call.
Bridge here.
The familiar tone of Lidler's voice vibrated into the first officer's ear.
What seems to be the problem? We got a fire down here in the coal bunker, neighboring boiler room 6, starboard side.
As Murdoch paused, he thought he heard panic coming from the wheelhouse. Lightoller cursed under his breath.
Inform the captain. Instruct a fire team to report to me here in less than 10 minutes. Yes, sir. How bad is it?
Murdoch looked at Andrews, who was carefully studying the port wall of the ship's hull. The shipbuilder was worried.
Bad, Mr. Lightoller.
Murdoch pushed the receiver back into place. The communicator turned itself off.
Mr. Bell?
Yes, sir.
Start transferring the safe coal from the starboard side of the bunker to the port.
Bell scratched his head.
I don't know, sir.
You don't know what, chief?
Sir, not wishing to question your orders, but don't you think that transferring that much coal into one bunker is unwise?
Murdoch studied the engineer.
Explain.
That much coal on one side of the ship, Bell stated. It's going to cause one hell of a list to the bow.
Oh, hell,
Murdoch whispered.
Didn't think about that. Do it. Maybe when we reach New York, I can work out a way to get you and your crew a bonus. After all, you'll be saving the line a hell of a lot of money.
Yes, sir,
Bell beamed. The idea of extra money was enough to make a sailor return from the dead.
We'll take care of it. Helping the firemen every step of the way, we will.
Bell ordered a small team of men to help. He grabbed extra shovels and disappeared from the boiler room with a tight smile on his face.
Come on, lads. Look alive. Every man gets a shovel.
Murdoch shook his head, admiring the spirit of capitalism. Andrews, on the other hand, had more pressing things on his mind.
How's it look?
Asked Murdoch, returning to Andrews' side.
Puzzling.
Andrews took a slide rule from his jacket pocket. He started pointing his fingers at several rivets against the hull's wall, adjusting his ruler, giving the first officer a concerned look.
In fact, I'd say the situation is unsettling. What? The fire?
Oh, to hell with the fire.
Andrews was paying more attention to his slide rule.
By the way, Mr. Murdoch, that fire was no accident.
No accident?
I know those bunkers. You cannot start a fire from the bottom of them. They're too deep. Not enough oxygen. Now what's this business with the slide rule?
All in good time, Mr. Murdoch.
Andrews returned to his rivet counting. Murdoch had enough. With his ship on fire, his clothes covered with dust, and his best jacket torn to shreds, the man was losing his patience. The first officer was going to call it a day. He ordered the firemen to their posts, instructing them of their duties, and left the boiler room exhausted. With the first officer gone, Andrews was allowed to investigate his find. Occasionally, a clank from a shovel or a coal-induced cough interrupted his calculations, but Andrews didn't mind.
"This hull has less than 3 million rivets in it," Thomas said.
"That's impossible. I personally signed the order, counting them myself. What the bloody hell's going on here?"
In the back of Andrews' mind, a question started to form. It was an issue that was horrifying and revolting. He didn't want to think it. He tried to put it out of his mind. However, it continued to haunt him.
Were corners cut on the Titanic to line certain pockets?
For the first time in his life, Andrews prayed that he was wrong. Boiler Room Number 6, Starboard Coal Bunker, 2:30 a.m.
Put your backs into it, men,
Bell coughed. Taking a small cloth from his shirt pocket, he tied it around his face, blocking his nose and mouth from the thick dust storm raised by the moving of the coal. The job was not an easy one.
Move aside, yelled a fireman as he connected a water hose to a nearby pipe.
Bell gave the firefighter a stern look, not approving of his clip manner, and surrendered his piece of floor, allowing the young man to pass. Although his team had their hands full with the removal of the safe coal, the fireman had to face the fire. The bunker was dark. The airborne coal dust created an electrical eclipse, giving the whole room the feeling that one was working in a mine shaft. Firemen, readying their hoses, prepared for the worst. The heat was fantastic. The men sprayed jets of water up at the roof, hoping gravity would do the job for them. If the water seeped down through the coal, maybe the fire could be put out before the stokers reached it. Clink! Bell's concentration was broken when he heard a strange sound coming from one of his men's shovels. Coal made a simple slashing sound. This noise was heavier. Dead.
Someone's lost their hammer, a stoker said.
Bell walked over to where the stoker was standing and investigated. The hammer was of the type used by baggage handlers to move heavy equipment, not the kind of tool to be found floating in the middle of an island of coal.
You found it in there? Asked Bell, pointing in the direction of the coal. Aye, sir.
Bell thanked the stoker, telling him to continue with his work. It wasn't 2 seconds later when, upon returning to his duties, that the stoker discovered Wiggins' body. A deck, Captain's Quarters, 3 o'clock a.m. Alone in his cabin, Captain Smith was retiring for the night. He left Lightoller at the helm to be replaced by Murdoch, and all seemed well. He grabbed a book off a small shelf next to his bed, and it was his intentions to lose himself in literature, hoping to fall asleep before he reached the third chapter. So many things had happened. Too many things to forget. A knock echoed through the tiny cabin.
Come!
Smith gave the door a hard stare. He took his reading glasses off and prepared himself for his uninvited guest. He hated intrusions, but accepted them as captain. Harold Bride opened the door and gave his captain a warm smile.
Nice warning, sir. Just thought that I'd bring them to your attention before you turned in.
It's good that you came now, Mr. Bride. In a few moments, I would have been sleeping.
A hint of guilt crossed the young wireless operator's face.
I did not mean to intrude, sir.
I know, son, I know.
Smith reached out his hand, silently asking to see what the officer had brought him.
Never be afraid to wake your captain. A good one always sleeps with one eye open.
Smith studied the yellow pages in front of him and was impressed to see that the Titanic had received a message from her sister ship, the Olympic.
Good Christ, Smith exclaimed. Did you actually hear a wireless report from the Olympic?
Faint, sir, but it was there.
Amazing. She's at least 300 miles away. How on earth can you manage such a thing?
Bride shifted in his shoes. It wasn't enough that he had to explain the principles of his machine's uses to board passengers. Now he was explaining them to the captain. If it weren't for the honest, boyish expression in Smith's eyes, he would have given the old man the same drab explanations he gave everyone else.
Sir, the Titanic's transmitter is the most powerful one afloat. Nothing can escape her ears.
Amazing. Do you know how I had to communicate to ships when I was your age?
I can hardly guess, sir.
Yell, Smith said with a giggle. I had to stand on deck and yell, much to the expense of my singing voice. How times have changed. Soon ships won't need captains.
I doubt that, sir.
Do you now?
Smith gave Bride a proud nod, handing him back his ice warnings.
Give those to Mr. Murdoch, then post them on the weatherboard.
Yes, sir.
Bride left, once more apologizing for his intrusion. Smith returned to his reading. A whistling sound stopped Smith's reading. A red light was blinking on his communicator. He pulled up the phone's listening device, and the telephone clicked to life.
Smith here?
The sounds of men shouting, panic, and escaping steam rang into the captain's ears.
Bell here? Yes. We found another body. It's Wiggins, sir. He was buried in the coal. I believe the fire was started to help cover up the crime.
Bell paused, coughing coal dust from his lungs.
Sir, we have a murderer on board.
Smith dropped his book. He would never finish it.
Are you certain, Mr. Bell? This is not a thing to be guessing at. We must be sure. I'd stake my oath on it, sir. His throat was ripped out, just like the other ones. Keep things quiet, then.
Smith moved the earpiece away from his face. He put his clothes back on and left his cabin. A deck, first class promenade, 3:15 a.m. Parker finally found the strength to leave his bed. He marveled at the pure beauty the calm Atlantic held within her depths on a cold April night. A rattling sound caused him to look up, noticing the huge gold and black smokestacks. All 4 stacks were rattling due to the brisk winds blowing against them. Practically the only one on deck, he noticed servants in the main dining room placing silver trays in their resting place, maids wiping down chairs and tables, and officers going over the inventory, making sure that those working remained honest. Alone on deck, he had a chance to explore,
and to discover just how big the Titanic really was. There was also the matter with Catherine. This simple encounter introduced him to chapters in his life he never thought possible. Parker came to rest by one of the lifeboats, which seemed to take up most of the deck. Andrews once told him that the whole ship was a lifeboat. The statement at first made him laugh. How could a boat be built not to sink? Seeing the Titanic's might, her size, how could one argue the fact? Catherine was the puzzle. She managed, in such a simple form of physical touch, to cause such an unusual sensation of complexity in Parker's thinking that it was almost frightening. A feeling that only came over him when faced with a historical question or searching for the origins of an ancient artifact. Unlike the puzzlement of his job, this confusion was of the kind that held within its boundaries no logical conclusions.
"I wonder if she cares for me," Parker said out loud to no one. "Stupid. Why would she do what she has done if she did not?"
Parker walked past the lifeboat, looking over the side of the ship. He placed his hands on the white rail, giving attention to the foam caused by the hull slicing through the ocean below. Fish of some type Parker did not recognize raced with the mighty ship, probably attracted by the vibrating of the reciprocating engines. Parker's stomach turned. Love soon left his heart.
"Not to jump ahead of myself, but how can I ever plan a family if I don't have a future? Dear God, help me find those who have stolen Kare. Thomas informed me that my cargo was one of the last loaded. There was no way for the thieves to take it off the ship. No one requested cargo to be unloaded in France or Ireland, so that means that the mummy and her kidnappers are still on board."
Parker heard the sounds of approaching footfalls. He absentmindedly checked his pocket watch. He had been staring at the water for over an hour. He noticed a dark figure walking toward him and waited. It was Captain Smith.
"Captain," Parker waved.
Smith stopped, hearing the voice. The captain looked past the lifeboat and saw a figure standing, waving a hand. Comically, a pocket watch hung from the thumb.
"Why, bless my soul, if it isn't Mr. Parker. Are you alive, then? Back on your feet?" "I am. I offer you my apologies for my weakness."
Smith walked over to him, placing a hand on Parker's shoulder.
"Never be ashamed of being human, son. You were given a painful shock, and your life's work was stolen from you. I would have done no less."
Parker was almost afraid to ask the question.
"Has there been any news? Any sign of Kare?"
"Kare?" Smith asked, confused. Parker noticed the captain's confusion.
"My property, sir."
Smith silently shook his head.
"No. I have wired a call to New York. No cargo will be removed until all boxes, bags, and trunks are inspected. Customs of the land and all that lot."
Parker's breathing relaxed.
"Thank you, Captain. I am greatly in your debt." "Think nothing of it."
Smith started to walk off.
"All in an officer's duty."
For an instant, Parker was able to forget his troubles and actually study the look of worry on the captain's face.
"Captain Smith,"
Parker called after the officer, quickening his step, ultimately walking down the deck with him.
"Is something bothering you?"
Smith stopped his walking.
"A second murder has occurred."
"Impossible." Parker was totally amazed.
"I only wish that it were."
Smith paused, letting out a hurting laugh.
"I chose this voyage in a mere attempt to end my career on an honorable note. Look at what it has cost me. A killer. What are your intentions?"
Smith gave the question some thought.
"I'm going to turn the ship around."
"The voyage?"
"Aye, that's a tricky one," Smith said. "This is a matter for Scotland Yard, not the White Star Line. You might end your career before you know it."
Smith heard the tone of warning in the American's voice, and he agreed with it. Not saying a word, the captain left Parker alone. An impossible task lay ahead of him. Ismay had to be told. Chapter 9. B-Deck, Suite B-51, 3:30 a.m.
"You're going to do what?"
Ismay yelled, his face turning pale with panic. Bruce Ismay practically choked on the red wine he had been sipping.
Dressed in red and white striped pajamas, the man's livid expression almost matched his greedy eyes. If the Titanic failed to reach her New York destination, Ismay knew that it would mean financial trouble for the White Star Line.
After the fire is put under control, I'm going to wire Southampton Harbor, informing them that we are returning to port, Smith explained, trying to calm Ismay down.
This is the Titanic, Captain Smith.
Ismay's hand found its way to a nearby nightstand, dropping his glass on its wooden top.
I know, Mr. Ismay, Smith confirmed. I did read the name as I boarded her.
Ismay shut his mouth, gaining control of his thoughts.
Do you realize what you are doing, sir? We will be a laughingstock. I can hear the jokes from Cunard as we speak. The mighty Titanic couldn't even finish a first voyage.
We are talking murder here.
Smith raised his voice.
Then let the Americans handle it when we reach New York, Ismay pleaded. I know a few men on the police force there. They seem efficient in what they do. Murder is their business.
Nevertheless, I am in command here. We will be turning back as soon as it is safe to do so. I have ordered the bridge to slow our speed.
You will do no such thing,
Ismay shouted, jumping from his bed. The man was in a panic. The panic of a worried businessman.
Please consider what you are planning to do. White Star poured every pound she had into the Olympic. A hell of a lot is riding on this tub.
Smith studied Ismay's reactions. He couldn't begin to understand them, but he did take heed of the fact that Ismay believed in what he was saying. It was his sworn duty as Commodore of the Line to make sure that his passengers were traveling on a safe ship. A nervous twinge went through the length of his body, remembering the warning Parker had given to him about the ending of his career.
Now she's a tub, the captain questioned.
Ismay regained his composure. The chairman poured himself another drink. He was right about one thing. If the Titanic failed to reach New York, he was finished and would never see himself as controller of the White Star Line. He had worked hard and wasn't going to let a nervous seaman ruin his chances.
Listen to me, Smith,
Ismay said, pointing a warning finger at the captain. Smith straightened his frame, saying,
You will address me as Captain Smith. I'll treat you in any manner of title I see fit. You are just an employee here, sir. I am your boss.
Ismay paused, staring Smith down.
Turn this ship around, and I'll relieve you of your command. Under whose authority?
Mine! Ismay shouted. I run the company that owns this ship, so that means I own you.
Ismay gave the captain an evil smirk. His mustache curled, showing white teeth below.
Hear me when I say that your record of service will mean nothing when I get through with you. I have powerful friends who could make your retirement a living hell.
Captain Smith found himself caught between conflicting reactions. One, to apologize. The other, throw Ismay off his ship. It had been many years since he had been threatened for doing his duty, the first since working for White Star.
Aye.
Smith bit his lip, choosing the first impulse.
I'm sorry. I will instruct Mr. Murdoch to increase speed.
Ismay calmed himself.
Thank you, Captain. You have chosen wisely.
A feeling of regret crossed his face. Deep down, he liked Smith.
I'm sorry that you had to be put in your place, EJ, but nothing can stop this ship. Nothing.
Smith walked toward the cabin door. He had never felt so dead inside as he did at that moment. He knew that he would regret not hitting Ismay when he had the chance.
Aye, sir.
Smith slammed the door behind him. B deck, first class promenade, 4:20 a.m. Steve Wallace, one of many first-class passengers, stepped out onto the promenade deck, knowing that he had to be one of only a few people awake. He wanted to smoke a cigar in peace. The moonlight lit up half of the deck, creating a series of eye-catching shadows. Wallace was excited about New York. After working so hard to build a fortune in the South African diamond mines, he was about to cut a deal with one of America's richest millionaires. Years of work were starting to pay off. If it hadn't been for the coal strike, Wallace probably would have never run into John Astor. With a new family to think about, Wallace was pleased to hear that Astor was looking for some solid investments for his new wife and child.
When Wallace mentioned the fact that he owned a line of diamond mines, Astor jumped at the chance to purchase them. Why not? He had already made his fortune and had all the money he could ever spend. Upon reaching New York, he would sell the mines for $12 million. Not a bad day's work. Wallace felt a certain uneasiness come over him. It was a feeling he knew well. He was being watched.
Is anybody there?
All the deck lights were shut off and had been powerless for over an hour. It was always the policy of the White Star Line to turn off excess lighting after midnight in the hopes that electrical power might be saved when needed the most. Nobody on regular occasions was up and running about during these hours, and therefore the lights weren't needed anyway. A movement caught Wallace's eye.
"Can I help you?"
he asked, shouting down the deck at a shadowy figure. With his eyes focused on the other end of the deck, Wallace threw his cigar overboard.
"If this is some kind of game, you will see that I am not amused."
The lone intruder was probably a bored child who couldn't sleep, so to pass the night, decided to explore the ship.
"Well, I'm going to bed,"
Wallace told himself as he tightened his grip on his ivory walking stick.
"I won't become the brunt of a child's silly prank. Damn them for ruining my smoke."
A fright came over him. He couldn't move his feet. For an instant, Wallace thought that the moon was playing tricks on him. His mother told him that the moon could do that to a person, drive one mad. It was the only way to explain what he saw. Stretching out rotten limbs, a horrible figure was inching its way toward him, its arms outward as if pleading for Wallace to help. A gaping mouth popped open, allowing a cloud of dust to escape from lungs that it would never use. The air was filled with the rot and smell of natron. Wallace pulled on his walking stick, withdrawing from its secret compartment a thin sword. He placed his hands on the gleaming blade. Every inch of his body was shaking with terror.
"I must warn you. I know how to use this."
The monster paid no heed. It continued its advance. Wallace's eyes focused on the monster's chest, slicing the silver blade through the icy air, driving it home. Kare looked down at the shiny blade that made its mark between her breasts and pushed her attacker, causing him to fall to the deck. She pulled the sword out of her body and pointed the sharp end back at Wallace. Her intentions were clear.
"No, please,"
Wallace trembled. He pleaded for pity where there was none to give. A sharp wind blew across Wallace's neck. He wanted to scream but found it impossible. As his hands grasped his throat, he tried in vain to hold back the blood. Rotten teeth inched forward, making their way toward his face. As the Titanic's whistles blew off excess steam, Kare cloaked her magic over her latest victim. No one heard the screams. Chapter 10. A Deck, Officers' Quarters, 7 o'clock a.m. Second Officer Lightoller was roused from his bed by a woman's scream. The night watch had taken its toll on the young man, but the scream was so near his window that he couldn't help himself. Filled with fear and curiosity, Lightoller leapt from his bed, flung on his bathrobe, placed his shoes on the wrong feet, and tripped on his hat. He had managed to look up at his window, noticing that several passengers blocked it.
"What in bloody hell is going on here?" he wondered.
If he was to investigate anything correctly, he knew that he had to put on his clothes. The officer reached for a clean uniform.
"If the captain had seen me dressed like this, he would have had me transferred. I wouldn't blame him."
Lightoller smelled the tea in the air. Anyone who worked the hours he had owed everything to the power of a hot cup of tea. He made a mental note. After checking on the disturbance, raid the kitchen for a cup. Lightoller left his quarters and walked up to a small hallway leading to the exit and ran into Captain Smith, who, by all appearances, had also been awakened by the telltale scream. It took all Lightoller had inside him not to laugh at his captain. The old man's shoes were on the wrong feet.
"What's all this racket, Mr. Lightoller?"
Smith yelled as he hid his uncombed hair under his hat.
"Can't a man get some sleep on his own ship?"
Lightoller thought it best to remain quiet. Smith darted out of the exit and onto the ship's deck. B Deck,
First Class Promenade, 7:10 a.m. Lightoller noticed the captain standing at the rail. He couldn't believe it. Smith was throwing up. Lightoller broke his way through the crowd of curious onlookers who, unlike his captain, had mightier constitutions.
All right, break it up. Not much to see. Go back to your cabins.
Lightoller finally saw what had everyone's attention.
Holy Mother of God.
Surrounded by half a dozen people, the mortal remains of Steve Wallace sat baking in the morning sun. His clothes soaked to their linings with thick black blood. His throat was cut. Lightoller felt like joining his captain. The man's face looked as if some unseen claw had stripped it off.
"Yes, yes, yes," came a voice from behind. "Just show me where the captain is, and I'll take care of it from here."
Lightoller saw Bruce Ismay walking toward him. Ismay was pounding his walking stick on the hardwood below his feet and was trying to announce himself as if he were king. Lightoller personally admired Ismay, but there were times when he even got on his nerves.
"Lightoller, isn't it?"
Ismay huffed, blinking his eyes open.
"Mr. Ismay,"
Lightoller acknowledged, tipping his hat. Ismay stopped in front of the second officer, staring at him keenly.
"Dear God, man, you're a walking mess. A little spit and polish is what you need."
Lightoller cleared his throat, waving his hands in the air, trying to warn Ismay of what he was not aware of. All eyes seemed to leave the mutilated body before them and focused on the arguing going on from behind.
"Sir," Lightoller pleaded, clearing his throat, "this is not the time." "This is not the time."
Ismay was furious. His voice caused thunder that could be heard halfway down the ship.
"You are an officer of this line, sir. You represent me. You bloody well will look your best when you rise in the morning. Do you understand?"
Smith couldn't bring himself to look back at the dead man behind him. He knew this man. He dined with him the night before. The man had a family waiting for him in New York. 2 children who would never again see their father.
"Get a hold of yourself, man,"
Smith cursed himself, embarrassed.
"You've seen death before. Stop vomiting. You'd think that you were a greenhorn."
Smith finally turned from the roaring sea to spot Ismay chastising one of his officers. The man had been yelling for over 3 minutes straight, and Smith hadn't heard a word.
"Stop that blasted noise,"
Smith yelled, not caring who was listening.
"Mr. Lightoller, call for the ship's surgeon. Tell him that I have another one for him."
Ismay's mouth stopped. Relieved that Ismay's wrath was no longer focused on him, Lightoller said,
"Aye, sir."
The second officer ran down the length of the deck, disappearing behind a pair of swinging doors.
"Captain Smith, I say, this is quite extraordinary."
Ismay suddenly noticed the small crowd looking on. For his image's sake, Ismay smiled his brightest smile.
"What is this? A breakfast party?"
Before Smith could take any action, his eyes caught those of Murdoch's as he came off the bridge. The first officer was just off his morning watch, the second he had to pull in one day, and was curious to see what the commotion was all about. Horror-struck, the first officer searched his captain's face as if to find the answer to what he was looking at.
"Captain?"
Murdoch asked. The seaman showed respect for the murdered man and his feet, taking off his hat.
"Mr. Murdoch,"
Smith said, almost in a whisper. Smith motioned the first officer toward him and secretly continued in the man's ear.
"Go down to the purser's office. I want him to report to me personally." "For what?"
Murdoch couldn't take his eyes off Wallace's body.
"I want to know if there are any passengers on board who can handle this emergency until we reach New York."
Murdoch pulled his head back, giving his commander a surprised look. Smith hadn't enough time to inform him that the Titanic wasn't turning back.
"New York, sir. I thought Mr. Ismay sees differently."
Smith's eyes silently directed Murdoch's toward Ismay, who was looking on in the crowd. Ismay, it seemed, was also suffering from a weak stomach.
"We will continue the voyage."
There was helplessness in Smith's eyes which seemed to explain it all. Murdoch realized that Smith had been threatened in some way, and seeing that he was so close to retirement, the threat had to be a substantial one. Murdoch understood.
"I'll go see what I can do, sir.
With a salute, he was off to find the purser. Smith watched Murdoch leave until he was out of sight. Smith then turned his attentions to Ismay. His temper began to boil. He blamed Ismay for this murder. It was his arrogance that was allowing the madness to continue. Ismay's stomach ached with pain. He noticed the captain rushing toward him. Smith took off his jacket and lowered it over the bloodied face so that no other passerby would see.
"How could this have happened?" Ismay barked. "Don't you believe in keeping a watch on board your ship?"
Smith had had enough of this man. The captain grabbed Ismay by the arm. The two headed toward the first-class entrance.
"See here, man, show some respect," Ismay cried.
Smith was relieved to see that none of the other passengers were up yet. Alone, the two were going to have it out.
"A man was horribly butchered last night," Smith barked.
He was doing his part to keep his temper, but a wheezy stomach tested his patience.
"All you seem to care about is how your officers look in the morning."
Ismay saw the hurt in the old man's eyes. If he had known, he would never have acted in the manner that he had toward Lightoller.
"Captain, I am aware of the fact that I acted so much like a fool, but I was not conscious of the grave circumstances. Was the passenger an extraordinary man?" "To two children who will never see their father again, yes. He was a remarkable man."
Smith grabbed the foot of a bronze statue, a little cherub, as he took a seat at the bottom of the staircase.
"Mr. Ismay, please consider returning to Southampton. We have a killer on board."
Ismay heard enough. No matter what, the Titanic was going to finish her trip.
"The White Star Line has never returned to port. You of all men should know that."
The captain's eyes followed Ismay as he tramped up the stairs and stopped at the top. Ismay was standing next to the staircase's clock. The clock was ordinary. However, surrounding the clock was the best oak carving ever created for any seagoing vessel. High on her pedestal, the clock was flanked on both sides by two females. The figures were meant to symbolize honor and glory crowning time. The grand staircase was a work of art. Her carpeted stairs, plush and comfortable, supported the richest feet in the world. Lovely iron sculptures of roses and ivory laced her outer lines, giving dignity and strength to any hand that touched her. She was topped off with an enormous etched glass dome, shining the spirit of prosperity. Smith looked up at Ismay and was aware of what the man was implying. It had always been Smith's policy to get to the other side of the Atlantic and back again as soon as possible. Ice warnings were only to be paid attention to if they got in the ship's way. Safety was paramount, but also was the duty of completing one's voyage. All that was different now. The ships were different.
"Nevertheless," Smith barked, raising to his feet, "I have taken action."
"What?"
"I have asked the purser to join us here."
Ismay jawed. Smith had nothing more to add. The room's silence was filled with the sound of the elevator doors opening. The purser walked with Murdoch toward the captain and Ismay. The man was paying no attention to where his feet were taking him.
"Yes, Mr. Murdoch," said Smith.
"Sir, I think we have found who you're looking for."
Murdoch tapped the purser, who, with surprise, looked up from his ledger to see that he was standing in front of the captain.
"I've done some extensive research into this matter," said the purser with pride. "I think I have found a logical candidate."
"Candidate?"
Ismay peered. The man grabbed his walking stick, rejoining Smith at the bottom of the stairs.
"Candidate for what, may I ask?" "I asked Mr. Murdoch to see if there was a passenger on board qualified to investigate the murders until we reach New York."
"What about the master at arms?"
Ismay huffed.
"We don't just pay them to eat. Let them handle this. Why do we need to bother some passenger who's probably on vacation?"
"No, sir, he's retired,"
the purser pointed out. Smith gave Ismay a challenging glance to see if the company executive had anything further to add. When he did not, the captain gave his purser a nod.
"Who is this man?"
Ismay huffed, all too aware of Smith's suppressed laughter. The purser glanced at his book.
"Mr. Reginald Cotts, second-class cabin, E-deck."
The purser leaned forward as if to decipher his writing.
"He listed his occupation as Inspector, Scotland Yard, retired." "There, you see,"
Smith said. A man from the yard.
A retired man from the yard, Ismay pointed out. A smirk formed on his face. I dare say that he might ignore your request. The captain dismissed the purser. Both he and Murdoch left via an elevator. Ismay and Smith were left alone.
Why do you oppose this?
Smith was genuinely upset.
This Kotz is a second-classer.
If I were to buy a ticket for this voyage, I would have to settle for second class. Do you consider me redundant?
Not at all. Ismay nervously smiled.
Then I shall ask for Mr. Kotz's assistance.
Ismay groaned with protest. E deck, second class stateroom, E4, 8 o'clock a.m. Reginald Kotz awoke to the rapping on his cabin door. Someone was paying a social call.
Damn it,
he yawned, fighting his tired eyes open.
Never fails. Every time I stay up late, someone always wakes me early.
Kotz jumped up out of his bed, responding to the second wave of knocking.
Never fear, Kotz shouted to his unknown visitor. I am coming. You have awakened me.
The second-class staterooms on board the Titanic were as good as any first-class accommodations anywhere else on the globe. If one never paid attention to the class barriers located throughout the ship, they would think that they were on a first-rate voyage. Kotz was really living it up. He couldn't remember when he had a more rewarding time. Kotz tried to focus his eyes in the morning light. The clock in his bedroom read 8:02 a.m.
Whoever it is better have a good reason, he grumbled, taking his slippers out from under his bed, putting his feet into them.
There was another knock at the door.
Soon,
Kotz shouted, not really appreciating the visitor's lack of patience. Kotz grabbed a blue bathrobe, threadbare from washing in age, and covered himself, tying a knot with the robe's belt around his middle. Kotz's cabin was better than the houses and lodges he lived in during his 35-year stay with Scotland Yard. He had investigated everything from standard domestic violence to the infamous case of Jack the Ripper. He had seen all avenues of human ugliness. He saw this ship and his new life in Canada as a reward for not going crazy. Kotz headed toward the door. Although containing only a small bedroom, sitting room, and adjoining bathroom, the humble detective thought he was living in a palace. Kotz was surprised to see an old ship's officer standing at his door. At first, he thought that one of the passengers had probably reported or complained about his flute playing, but upon inspecting the officer's shoulder pads, Kotz came to the logical conclusion that the elderly man was the ship's captain.
What can I do for you, Captain?
Smith didn't remember that he had met this man during the voyage, but it was evident that Kotz was aware of him.
Mr. Reginald Kotz. The last time I checked, that was my name. Of Scotland Yard.
Retired, sir, Kotz pointed out.
Smith started to shift in his boots. There was obviously something on his mind, but the words seemed stuck in his throat, unwilling to come out. Kotz noticed the disheveled state of the man's uniform and had come to realize that the captain wasn't paying a social call. Kotz knew something had happened. He was aware that it was something terrible.
Captain, do come in.
Kotz opened his door fully.
Please sit down. I will pour you a glass of port to help calm your nerves.
Smith entered Kotz's cabin, taking a seat in a finely crafted oak chair located next to the sitting room's only window. He placed his hat on the chair's nearby writing table and gave his host a curious stare.
How is it that you come to know that I am nervous? Smith asked.
Kotz poured a glass of port from a ceramic bottle and laughed at Smith's genuine surprise.
Simple. A captain on a liner comes to visit one of his second-class passengers early in the morning. He is pale, noting tension. His uniform is sloppy, indicating haste.
Kotz paused, pointing to Smith's tousled hair.
His hair is messed, signifying a current rush of surprise. These lead me to the conclusion that a terrible crime has occurred, requiring services not found among the runaround master-at-arms.
Kotz handed Smith his port, holding back a wave of personal satisfaction.
Quite correct, sir, Smith said with amazement. Simple deduction.
Smith drank the port in one swallow.
Then I was right, Kotz said. It is murder.
Smith placed his empty glass next to his hat and nodded.
We discovered the body about an hour ago. I was awakened from my sleep by a woman's scream.
This unfortunate soul, Kotz asked. Was he a passenger?
Yes, this time.
This time?
Upon leaving France, we discovered a gentleman's body in a cargo crate, and just the other day, the body of a crewman was found buried in a coal bunker.
Smith paused.
I wanted to turn the ship around, but I was told not to.
Kotz understood. He often had problems with his superiors. Connected men, rich people who had neither his experience nor intelligence and therefore held him down. The curse of the common man.
Had the same problems while working on one of the Ripper murders, Kotz said as he threw off his robe, wishing to change into more suitable clothing. You were involved with the Ripper cases.
Quite so. Kotz changed into a brown suit. A police official got into a bit of a scuff with me when I had wanted to preserve a sample of the Ripper's writing when I discovered it close by, next to one of his latest victims. He disagreed. Kotz paused. He tied a green scarf around his neck. The retired detective's face turned hard.
He was connected. I was not. His actions cost me a promotion. Against better judgment, he destroyed the only physical evidence the Ripper ever left us.
Did the Yard ever find out who he was?
No, Kotz said with regret. My theory, which was totally ignored, was that the Ripper was one of the many Russian immigrants that had been turned down a license to practice.
Amazing, Smith said. I spent most of my time at sea and have had little time to catch up on current events.
That was a long time ago, Kotz said. Anyway, if I were a man of connections, maybe the Ripper case would have been different. God knows not finding him has been one of my greatest regrets.
Smith let the disappointment, which had shown plainly on the man's face, set in. From personal experience, Smith knew that regret was a powerful motivator. Smith spent his time trying to figure out just how to ask the man for his help. Kotz noticed the way Smith was playing with the brim of his hat. The man was asking for something.
I'm sorry, Captain.
Kotz explained, very much feeling for Smith's dilemma.
I am retired now. I have no authority on this ship. We are in international waters. Besides, I am in no mood to pamper wealthy folks as I try to figure out which one of them is the killer.
Kotz paused, placing his flute's bag in his waist pocket.
No, Captain. This is a matter for the police in New York. I understand, Mr. Kotz, Smith said, troubled. Why, may I ask, are you so sure that it was one of my first-class passengers who was responsible for these killings?
Kotz placed his hands in his back pockets and stood looking at Smith with honest eyes.
Show me a man who has suffered beyond his due, and I will show you a millionaire who has benefited from the sorrows.
Smith cleared his throat. This conversation was going nowhere.
Captain, I see that you are disappointed in me, and I am sorry.
Kotz, sincere in his words, offered Smith some minor help.
If I were you, I'd check with the owner of the crate you discovered the first body in. If anyone knows of the motivation behind these killings, it's probably him.
Smith shook his head.
We got nothing there.
What was the owner's response?
The man practically fell apart.
Interesting. Kotz's nature for investigating started to take over. His caution quickly dissolved.
May I ask why? The man, Dennis Parker by name, owned the crate. It contained an ancient mummy he was taking to New York, but when opened, the box contained a dead man. The mummy was nowhere to be found.
This is important, Kotz insisted. Did the murders occur before or after the theft?
After, now that I think about it.
Smith's eyes widened in surprise.
Could this simple theft be connected?
It's entirely possible, Captain. People have been willing to kill for less. The men were interrupted by a knock at the door.
Looks like I'm the center of attention today, Kotz beamed, answering his door.
Upon opening the door, Kotz discovered another man. Dressed quite different, this man was obviously not a member of the crew. Bruce Ismay bolted into the cabin, joining Smith.
Do come in, Kotz said, rather bitterly.
Appreciated, said Ismay in a condescending fashion.
Mr. Ismay,
Smith said, paying close attention to the growing dislike in Kotz's face.
This is Mr. Kotz.
Ismay, not saying a word, waved a glove in the air, as if to give Kotz his permission to exist on Earth.
Has the man agreed to help you?
Smith cleared his throat, insulted by the way Ismay was acting.
The man has not, Kotz stressed. Captain Smith, who the hell is this man to think that he can walk into my cabin and insult me?
I am Bruce Ismay.
I don't give a damn if you're Queen Victoria. You will treat all under this cabin's roof with respect, or you will leave.
Really?
Huffed Ismay, not at all worried about the threats.
The nerve.
Mr. Kotz has declined our request, Smith said, wishing to leave the room.
The tension was starting to build. Smith, having talked with Kotz, was under the impression that the detective had a grudge against anyone who was wealthy.
Gentlemen, let us try to remain calm, Smith pleaded, caring more for Ismay's safety than Kotz.
You mean he wouldn't even help you, the captain?
Ismay continued, an arrogant chuckle echoing in his voice regarding Kotz with a hard stare. Smith cleared his throat.
Although I have informed Mr. Kotz of our dire situation, he has declined our request. He believes this matter is for the police in New York.
He does.
Ismay gave Kotz an arrogant glance as if to silently say he had been right.
Quite correct. Capital bit of logic there.
Kotz, having had his fill, decided it was time for another round of port. Silently excusing himself from Smith and Ismay, Kotz and the captain exchanged glances. Smith, his eyes piercing through the morning sunshine, tried his best to express the apology he wanted to speak, but under the circumstances could not. Kotz felt for the man. Ismay smirked, watching Kotz drink his beverage. He didn't like this man. He was common. Common had no place on board the Titanic.
Look at him, Smith, Ismay stated. Drinking. Before breakfast. The idea. It has been my impression, sir, that we awakened him from a deep sleep. Perhaps he is just trying to find a way to regain his composure, Smith added, whispering.
Composure, indeed.
Ismay placed his bowler back on his head, adjusting it to a jaunty angle. He flung his gloves up in the air as if to tell the captain that he wished to leave.
He is riffraff. I do not want to give him the power to run about my ship. He might steal something. Sir, I protest, Smith growled. After all, we came to him.
Then let us leave him where we found him.
Kotz swallowed the last of his port. He was a keen listener and had heard every word spoken by his guests. The drinking glass at the writing table with a thundering blast.
Captain Smith, Kotz said, it's my understanding that you have preserved the crime scene if I agreed to help.
Now listen here, man,
Ismay started to say, but was cut off by a sharp look from Smith.
Yes, the captain confirmed. However, I have placed a tarp over the victim so that no passerby or child may see him. Good man. I was concerned that your men might have ruined what few clues remain, but I'm sure that Mother Nature has beaten you to that. Does this mean that you will help?
Kotz gave Ismay a hard glance.
It does.
Ismay thundered out of the cabin, slamming the door behind him. Smith was surprised when he heard a genuine belly laugh coming from Kotz's mouth.
He's going to be a problem, Smith warned. I dare say that he might even blame me.
Captain, do not worry so. I have handled his kind all my life.
He's a powerful man, sir.
Aye. If my grandfather had wheels, he'd be a wagon.
Smith controlled his surprise as the two left the cabin to examine the body.
If Ismay had only kept his mouth shut, Smith mused, holding back a laugh, he would have gotten his way.
B deck, first class promenade. 8:37 a.m. As crewmen removed the gray tarp that had been covering the body, Kotz discovered the seriousness of Captain Smith's situation. They were dealing with a complete madman.
This is the way he was found, Kotz questioned.
Yes, sir, Smith insisted. By all accounts, he should never have been here.
Explain.
Kotz reached into his vest pocket, pulling out a small notepad he carried with him while on an official investigation, and started to write.
This area of the ship is usually closed after midnight,
Kotz stopped his writing.
Then why the body?
Smith didn't understand. He responded with a questioning silence.
Captain,
Kotz stated, trying to make his point clear.
If indeed this area is closed, then how did he end up here?